Hartford, Connecticut, on September 21st, 2004. The interviewer is William F. Morrill of Salisbury, Connecticut. Gordon.
Good morning.
Is that what you say, what the subject is?
Well, the subject is going to be my existence in this town, or my family's existence in this town since, I guess we moved here in 1970 to Lime Rock, the old homestead of Bergdahl on Route 112, just we used to jokingly call that East Lime Rock. It was a downtown Lime Rock and a West Lime Rock, and of course Lime Rock's what a little village of about 200 people, so it was pretty interesting. We got a big laugh out of that.
And Gordon, could you, actually, before you start on Lime Rock, could you just give a quick scoop about your, you grew up in Connecticut, didn't you?
I grew up in Weathersfield, Connecticut, the oldest town in the state, and although Windsor disputes that. Went to school at Tufts in Boston, Bedford, Mass, and got my DVM, my Doctor of Veterinary Medicine at Michigan State, in Lansing, Michigan, and this is where I met my wife.
When did you graduate?
Pardon me? When did I graduate? Tufts in 56, Michigan State in 61. And at Michigan State, I met Jerry, who became my wife, still married to me, surprisingly, I guess. But we've had a great life together. And we moved back to Michigan State. I took a position in Greenwich with Jack Robinson at the Blue Cross Animal Hospital on the Post Road. Practiced there for 9 years. Eventually got into a partnership with Jack. And after a number of years of partnership, we both decided, Jerry and I both decided, that with a young, growing family, that we would really like to get into a less populated area. We loved the northwestern part of this state, and realized that there was no veterinarian in Salisbury, and there had been a veterinarian by the name of Haynes who had moved to Florida, and so we felt that this would be a great spot to start an animal hospital. So we started searching for a place to live.
And so you were in Greenwich
for 9 years.
Okay. And then you moved up here when?
In 1970 to Lime Rock.
1970. Alrighty, and you moved to the old Bergdahl.
The old Bergdahl estate, Herb Bergdahl Sr. He had two sons. And they lived there, I believe they purchased from a man named Owens back in maybe 1929. And the Bergdahls actually never lived there full time. It was a weekend and vacation spot for them because they were New York City people. But by the time we were looking for a house, they were getting up in age and decided that they really couldn't maintain this very large Victorian house, a house that there were 8 bedrooms, very, very gorgeous house with a large, beautiful barn next door to it, and we converted part of the barn into the Lime Rock Animal Hospital and practiced in that building until 1997, December of 97, when Kent Kay and Milligan purchased my practice, and I moved to practice in New York, in Millerton, just over the line, and worked with my longtime associate and friend, Kent Kay, and continued to work for him for a number of years, retired, semi-retired, and have worked with him on and off ever since.
Okay, and your practice was mainly?
My practice was exclusively the companion animal, the small animal. Sort of interesting to me was
dogs and cats.
We occasionally see a snake. We occasionally see, gerbils and that type of creature, turtles,
and even a crow.
The crow, exactly. The hippies had a crow. We used to go to Did you? Really? Hickey's had a crow, Jim Hickey in town had a crow that used to go to all the kids at school, the grammar school up in Salisbury, and would sit and wait for the kids and then come home with the children. Well, this poor crow met up with something one day and lost, he had his paw, his claw was caught and broken, and we couldn't really repair it, so we had to amputate it. That crow's still one-legged, flew and landed all over Lakeville Village for many years. Interesting bird, really nice bird. But primarily, you know, primarily was small animal, dog and cat. We would see an occasional deer. Pete Begley, who at the time was conservation officer in the area, would bring some injured animals to me. And we worked on a number of deer for him. But it was just a great experience. My thrust was to do small animal because principally the guys around me, veterinarians around me, were doing mixed practice, and therefore principally around the road very early in the morning, and really didn't return to the hospital, their office, until in the afternoon.
And they were doing large animals.
And they were doing large animals, doing cow and horse and so forth and sheep. And so I was available, by being exclusively small, I was able to fulfill the small animal portion in the mornings and give, we thought, I think it worked, better coverage to the small animal clients in the area. Interestingly, we all got along very nicely as colleagues, and I don't believe there ever was any animosity amongst any of us because of what I was attempting to do. And as I say, Kent Kay, very early in my career up here, he and I became good friends, and he utilized my practice for various situations. His building actually burned to the ground. His animal hospital burned to the ground, and it took him, I don't know, 6 or 7 years to reestablish. But during that period of time, he utilized my surgery for doing his surgery, and I'm more or less with the anesthesiologist in those cases, and also the caretaker of his animals following surgery. So we had a very nice understanding. That, of course, proceeded to his purchasing my practice and become his associate, which is actually a nice way to do it because you don't have to worry about the business, the employee relations, and all the other. But it was a good run.
And what did you do in your spare time?
Well, of course, we were raising 4 children. And as we all know, they can be quite demanding of our time. I did get involved in the town. Bill Barnett came to me, I think, in 1972 and asked if I would run for the zoning board. And I'd always felt that it was important that any of us in business in the area, in the town, contribute to the town best we could. And so I did. I was elected and served for 20 years. And the gentleman sitting next to me was chairman for quite a few of those years. And he and I worked together very closely in zoning and had some rather difficult times in zoning with some of them. At that time, there was a pretty heavy demand for subdivision. And we had to work, Bill especially, to make sure that this was a controlled effort. We worked hard on planning, and that was really truly a great experience, a volunteer experience. And both Bill and I sort of left at the same time, left in the hands of John Higgins. And John Higgins, I guess, has been doing it for 22 years, and he's done a superb job. So that was a great spot. Plus I've served in a couple other areas. One of my favorite areas was Houstonic Daycare, where I was a director of that for a number of years and was involved in the building of the new building, not new now, it was 8-10 years old, over on Salmon Hill. That was...
Gordy, stop in there.
Yeah.
Check the tape.
Okay. Yep.
Stop. Okay, we're recording again on the Johnson interview. The other tape, or one of these two tapes, has a missing section. Okay, pick up with you were speaking about the daycare center and the new building.
That's where we ended with that, as I said, that was one of my real joyful experiences with working with those people and with the children, and being part of that, of being building chairman of that building. On buildings, I was also involved in 1990 and 1994 with the renovation, the $5.5 million renovation and new construction of the Salisbury Central School. In fact, Bill's wife worked his hand side by side with me on that. That was a very tedious project, but a very interesting project, and which I think came out quite decently for the town and for the children. I'm not an educator, of course, but I am a sports fan, and I was so pleased that the gymnasium that we ended up building has received so much attention from not only the school children, but from various groups in town that like to use it for sports. The gymnasium itself is an interesting anecdote about that. It was in the sort of the final stages of the construction, and I had to be down observing some of the work. We had put up, they put up some basketball backboards, and they were wooden backboards, or a composition backboard, two on each side and one at each end. And Boosman, the coach for the Boostonic basketball team, was in there at the same time. And he turned to me, he says, "Ford, he says, you can't have those composite backboards at both ends of that. You've got to have glass. That's what everybody has." And so I went back to the committee on the next committee meeting and said, "You know, I really want to go for glass backboards." And I got the price for them, and the cost is $1,500 more. Take down the composite ones, put up the glass, and they look so much better, and the kids like them, and it's very professional looking. Well, most of the members were wondering why I wanted to do that, and I tried to explain to them. They finally agreed to free up another $1,500 out of our contingency fund to do it. And that really, if you go down there and look at that, that's really a wonderful facility, and it's been well received by the community. And it, of course, it's a gymnasium with a stage next on in the side wall with the music room backs right up to it. So it has worked out to be very efficient for both the music program and for the staging of various school plays and school functions, and obviously for the sports. And that was a project that took a fair amount of time, and what was very rewarding is that we have a school that's functioning very well.
And before you got on the track toward completion of the renovations, you recall the false start of the first door?
Well, yeah, that was...
This was after the town hall burned down.
Yes. Okay, the town hall burning down was...
1985.
A huge tragedy. And there were workings for renovation of the school by another committee. And they had been started, and they had actually had some drawings and had been studying it. And of course, when the town hall was torched, that particular, had to go in the back burner, that issue and that project. And then we kicked it up in 1990 and got a referendum passed by the town.
But wasn't there a failure of the referendum first?
Our referendum? No.
You know, it was the first go around that was rejected.
You came in
for the second go around, I think.
Yes, I believe so,
successful.
And we had, you know, and we had to be very, very careful how that was presented. And we had a lot of good coaching about how to handle it. Buddy Trotter was first selected at the time, and we had, you know, people who had experienced the rough road on previous referendum, and so it was pretty well planned, pretty well studied, and covered. We covered, I think, most bases, and had a number of public meetings that allow us public to buy it and referendum passed.
Yeah, it was a great decision.
And we came in under budget by about $10,000. So that always looks nice, even though we added a number of wish list items near the end.
that amounted to many thousands of dollars. But I don't think we've got too much out for people monitored. There have been various contingencies in the school, teachers, students, parents, people on our board who want a certain thing, so the principal of the school who want a certain thing. I think we covered most everybody's wishes were granted.
And exactly what was your role in that? Did you give it?
I was chairman. I was co-chairman originally with Barbara Leibowitz. And Barbara Leibowitz and her husband moved to Florida. So, and I only took the co-chairmanship because I thought we could be able to split the duties pretty well. But when she left, and I was most obligated to continue as chairman. And it was fine. I mean, I really enjoyed it. And I think that I had a marvelous bunch of people working with me that you had. So, Roland Bates, Sue Morrill, Chris, I can't remember his name, the builder in town, his wife's on the Board of Education. Sorry, I can't remember his name at the moment, but Joe. He's a builder right on Main Street in town. His house on the house tour just the other day.
Oh, Brennan.
Joe Brennan.
Yeah.
Yeah. And he was very helpful. So we had, I probably forgotten one or two people, but we had a very good working group who were very observant and studied the plans and studied the work that had been done and came up with questions. Architects, of course, are a very interesting group of people. And we had some questions for them a number of times. We finally went to a manager, construction manager program, which in the long term, I think, saved us a fair amount of money and a fair amount of work on the volunteers part. A lot of cooperation from the principal at the time, Tom Bradley, and the head custodian, George Parsons, was very, very helpful to us during the construction. We were sort of monitoring, both those guys were monitoring things on a daily basis, walking around. I was up there most every day as well, but it was definitely a team effort.
So basically, your job was you were checking on the actual physical progress of the construction?
Yeah, talking to the construction manager, talking with the project manager, dealing sometimes with the architect. Back and forth with the architect, and had a great relationship with Mary Jo Owenet, who was the principal architect on the whole project. David LeBeau, and managed with the group called SLAM. And I had a good relationship with the architects, although they weren't always as cooperative as we would like. Bottom line is the money being made at the project. It's okay. I understood their position. They understood ours.
Okay. Why don't we go back to Lime Rock? When you first got here, what was Lime Rock like?
That's 1970. And Lime Rock was pretty much having its difficulties because of the Lime Rock racetrack, and there was quite a vocal group of people called Lime Rock Protective Association, I think that was their name, of which Mr. Bergdahl was one of the leading members and contributors financially to. And the thrust, of course, when we came there, I was interviewed by any number of members of that committee wanting me to join their committee and to be a vocal and hopefully financial contributor. And I withstood their barrage. I want to live here and see just how much of a problem it is to our family, to my business, etc. I knew the track was there. I knew them all about the noise. We had been up visiting the area and knew that it was very uncomfortable on certain days of the year because of the high traffic volume and the noise. But I grew to the point where it didn't bother us that much. the days that the track was very active, such as Memorial Day and Labor Day, we would just go to, over the grove, you know, take the kids over the grove and sort of stay away for that particular day. I understood their people's concerns about property values, and property values then and still are less in Lime Rock than they are in Lake Villa Salisbury, for instance. But it was a quaint little village, and very nice people, and we just got along well. And I got to be, not friendly, but I was acquaintance with a number of people at the track. And I know that zoning came into the issue for screening, and track agreed to, obviously, they've not to run on Sundays and to finish their running by 6 o'clock on Saturday nights, and that the screening, they have to screen from 112, and there was this enormous, little pine trees at the time, maybe 4 or 5 feet high, and now, you know, 35 years later, you drive by there, and they're huge. I mean, it was 50 feet in the air, and they completely blocked the people looking down in there. I'm not sure they block a lot of the noise, but they have changed the aspect of people sitting on the highway looking over at the track. But I think that the neighborhood and the town come to an accommodation with that track. And I have not really heard any real separate objections to the Lime Rock racetrack in many years. Have you ever made any?
No, it's certainly quieted down. Although not the track, but the objection. You were known as the mayor of Lima. What were your duties as mayor of Lima?
Duties as mayor of Lima. That was sort of a comical name given to me in zoning one day. And I guess it's, I don't think there was any, the title doesn't really mean much except that I was probably the one Lime Rock representative on some of the boards in town. I was zoning board. And, you know, I'm kidding, you would say, now wait a minute, we've got to think about the village of Lime Rock when we're discussing things, and people would laugh at me. But I did have concerns that we didn't want Lime Rock to be forgotten in any of the deliberations, and that the track was an issue, and we must keep that at the forefront. But it was just common to me. And as I said earlier, but you used to be a kid that, I said, where are you from? I said, East Lime Rock. Where is East Lime Rock? Well, there's West Lime Rock when you come in from 112 from Hotchkiss, that becomes West Lime Rock. There's downtown Lime Rock where the lodge was, and then East Lime Rock where I am. And he was the kid about that lodge.
Do you remember any stories about Lime Rock, the history of Lime Rock, that you would have heard of because you were not here at the time, but that had special meaning for you?
Well, only that I just some of the derivation, and I guess it was a mine gravel from it way back, and it was
in the area of the park.
Yeah. Oh, the village itself was very active down in Richard Barnum days when it was a very fairly wealthy apparently at one point, and then when the iron industry sort of crashed in the early 1900s, and by 1929 there were many, many houses for sale. I believe it was a realtor down there, Nitton, I believe, came in and purchased or his mother, I guess,
Stone,
who was Nitton's mother or mother-in-law, purchased many of the houses there. But there was gorgeous old houses all along the main drag. It was interesting, there were three lovely little houses right at, near the river, across the San Mateo River, that were homes for the workers in the foundry that was on the river. And of course, there's an old furnace right on the edge of the river, just over the, just past the bridge, starting to go towards up the hill from 112, going west. And that was not there, of course, but the foundation from the
It got washed out with the 55 flood.
I think it was destroyed with 55 flood, where that entire area, you know, was under a great deal of water. And Herb Bergdahl Jr. would show me pictures of what the flood looked like. It over the bridge down by where we live, over the bridge by 20 or 30 feet, I believe, was in the morning.
You mean on the brook? On the
Yeah, on the brook. It was,
So your barn would have been flooded?
The barn, I think only once in the entire history of that property, the barn was, well, no, beg your pardon, the barn was flooded in that late May storm. 1984, where we literally, we were surrounded by water. And my wife reminded Jerry and I the other day that it was, she was working at hospice, and when she came home one afternoon during this rain, she couldn't get the car down to our house, so she parked it up at the track and walked, took her stockings off, hiked up her dress, and walked through the water. And got into the house, and then she was sort of stranded by the next day because the water was just too deep to get across. I mean, you could get out on the roof. And the water did not get quite up to our house, but the basement did flood because the groundwater came up, of course. And we had our cars and everything else up on the hill behind us. The barn was flooded. My animal hospital did not get flooded, but it was, we were in that situation probably for 3 to 4 days.
Is that when you called me to borrow a rowboat to your basement?
Yep. Well, not the basement. I think borrow a rowboat from her to row over to the barn, to go in the barn to get some hay because we had some oil that was down there and was starting to show one to contain the oil. But when that receded, actually the stream, the San Raquel, rather, it used to go to the west of us and then behind us. I mean, that's its normal route. But during that storm, it came down the middle of 112 and, you know, was rushing by the front of our house. Following that, when the water receded, when you finally could get on the road was dry, there was a large pump of water across the street from us. And I noticed all of these fish jumping out of the water. And they were huge river carp that came into the Housatonic. And they were landlocked when the water receded. And I presume what was happening, they were getting frenzied and they were starting to lose oxygen. Well, it wasn't but maybe a couple hours later after I saw that and was taking photographs of them and so forth, that there were about 10 or 15 guys out there in their trucks with spears nailing these fish. I mean, they were really big. They must have been 3 or 4 feet long. Big river carp. And it was fascinating to see, but they obviously were landlocked and were going to succumb as the water got a little more. But that was, I guess you said the day before?
Yeah, that was May of 84.
Yeah, well then that was, I think, was what, a 75-year flood, they said? And the 55 was a 100-year flood. And that was the worst flood, truly, they had in that area for probably 100 years. But Lime Rock did change. I mean, as you said, the buildings were destroyed on up at the forge mill. And met upon sort of hard times where property values did drop, houses were being kept up. And so really, it's a nice little village. And as you say, I always try to promote Lima. Of course, then I moved to Salisbury, get out of the big house, and come to this very nice compact building we're in right now, Lion's Head. I still drive through Lime Rock and admire what's been done and how people have fixed up their homes. It's a nice little village. I don't think it's grown very much in population. There's not too much rebuilding.
Did you ever have much contact with Hezekiah Goodman?
Hezekiah Goodman was just a delightful guy and a very bright old Yankee. Well, I guess his original property was a grant from King George, as I understand it. I remember seeing that at some point. Maybe that was his sons who told me about that.
But there's 6 or 7 or 8 generations of Hezekiah
that lived in that property.
Yeah.
And he was a very, very bright guy, very interesting to talk to, and I don't think he was properly understood by Salisbury residents. I think he was just too much of an old Yankee. And he used to visit, and he was he was dog warden for a number of years. And of course, unfortunately, he had to take care of some of those dogs that were strays and had to take care of. I remember one great scene was one day, him driving down Route 112, and he had a huge wire cage strapped to the top of his beat-up old station wagon. With two dogs, bring it over to my place. And he picked the dogs up someplace in Salisbury and put them on top of this cage and was driving through town with his dogs up the top of the cage. And the other one of the time was in a winter scene, and the snow was really thick. 112 was hardly plowed, and I was in the animal hospital, which was right next door to our house. I looked up, and there was a cow at the front door of the animal hospital, sort of looking in. And I said, "Oh, geez, Hezzy's cows have gotten loose." And that was always the big game down in Lima, Hezzy's cows are loose. Because Hezzy had, I don't know, 10, 15 head of cattle that would probably get loose four or five times a year. He wasn't afraid of fixing fences. And sure enough, so I called him and said, "You got a cow down here in the front yard." And he said, "Oh, okay, I'll be down in a minute, Doc." Well, by the time we got here, there was a whole herd of cows. And they had moved from my house, and they were walking down 112 towards Route 7. Well, Hez came in, he said, "Where's the cow?" He said, "Well, they went that way, Hez." And I said, "Okay." So he got out of his car, had a bucket of grain, and he walked past our house down the middle of 112. Next thing I know, here comes Hezzy back up 112 with a bucket of grain in his hand and the lead cow walking right behind him and 15 other cows right behind them. And he walked back home, and that's how he got his cows home. And it was just a wonderful scene. It was something out of the 1800s, you know. There were no cars around that time. It was snowing so heavily and so forth, and he had these cows. I always enjoyed it. He knew a lot about the stock market. He invested quite a bit. And I was always trying to give stock tips. He got involved when the town wanted to put the dump in Lime Rock. We enlisted his help because the property they were going to put on was his old gravel pit. And Tom White at that time was on the refuse, whatever they call themselves, commission to look for a new site. And Tom was interesting enough, decided along with a bunch of us in Lime Rock, we didn't want it in Lime Rock. So he sort of changed the stripes a bit and joined our group. And then there was this very large, I think it was one of the largest town meetings I've ever been to, at Hotchkiss, in Hotchkiss Auditorium. And the commission that was in charge of finding the site was hearing. And they were, six or seven were sitting in a row on the stage, and they were going to present this program. And we had already contacted a lawyer in Hartford to represent us, and that was
Kelly,
yeah, who was, I guess, head of the Democratic Party at the time in the state of Connecticut.
John Kelly.
Kelly Spellacy. And huge man. He must have been 6'5", 300 pounds, very dominating presence. Well, anyway, Thomas Light was sitting next to Bill Barnett. And Thomas had not said anything to the commission about his change of heart until that night at that meeting. And the microphone was passed to him and said, "Well, I oppose this position of the site on Teddy Goodman's property, and I think we should turn it down and we should look for a better solution." And, you know, with that, the crowd erupted in cheers, at least the crowd flywalked. And I think we packed the audience pretty well. And then Bill Barnett turned to Tom Light. Only a thing we couldn't hear him saying, but Tom Light told him. He said, "Tom Light, you will never get anything in this town again." And of course, that was an empty threat because he didn't have that kind of power. But poor Tom was up there all by himself. I think he was the fish, and the sharks were all over. But it turned out that the position we maintained won and was reversed. And of course, the outcome is that we did the transfer station on 112. I mean, on Route 41.
Okay, we're going to stop there and check the tape and flip it over.